Learned Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learned Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgro seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learned Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 14th day of July, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Lisa Jones of the Andersons right here in Champaign County. In today's agricultural news, the U.S.-South Korea FTA is finding new life. A USDA report says taxing soft drinks and the like by 20% would help Americans shed pounds. And a new poll says the world's third largest economy is expected to grow slower next year than this year. The poll also suggests China's trade surplus will shrink. It does not say that will come on the heels of increasing agricultural imports, but we can be hopeful. Dave Dickey will be along in a moment with these and many more ag news stories. In fact, Dave will be here for a lot of today's show, as I'm out of the office and will be for about 10 days. Our thanks to him for filling in while I'm gone, although I will be here today to talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City and for an archive edition of The Farming World. We'll run the very first program in that series. It's from April the 5th. The guest is Bob Dineen of the Renewable Fuels Association. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Rebecca King in Galesburg at 309-341-5007. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Wednesday afternoon, futures settled like this. Kansas City September wheat 572.5, up 5.75. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 559, up 9.75. July corn 375.25, up 8.5. December 396.25, up 9.25. Go out to May of 2011, 415.75, up 8.25. July beans 1036, up 5.5. September 975.25, up 8.25. November 962, up 7.5. July soybean meal 313, up a dime. July soybean oil 3805, up 13 cents. August live cattle 9232.5, up 137.5. And that is Wednesday afternoon's settlements in Kansas City and in Chicago.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Here is a look at meteorologist Drew Lerner's weather highlights. He says that today it will be warm and humid, with not much risk for rain on the balance of the day. Showers and thunderstorms are expected, though, Thursday and Friday, with limited rainfall resulting. Random showers of mostly insignificant rain will occur this weekend. Net drying may occur most often over the coming week. The second week temperatures will trend warmer than usual. And two progressive west to east moving high-pressure ridges were advertised in today's computer forecast model runs for next week, with perhaps a high-pressure ridge getting more significant later next week.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Looks like the weather forecast has futures knocking back on the door of its recent move to the high.
Yeah, it was a tip-off this morning when I got the private forecasters in with their predictions of warm temperatures. And, of course, we are looking at 100-degree temperatures in the state of Kansas. We're looking at 90s basically almost everywhere in the state of Illinois and, you know, the mid-90s in Iowa, big corn-producing state. I did talk to one of my prominent meteorologists that I like to talk to, and he did mention two things that I thought was extremely interesting. And he said, you know, this Des Moines with the mid-90 temperature and the dew points extremely high, we're looking at a tropical climate in the state of Iowa and parts of Illinois. In other words, it's very muggy outside, and of course that, and, you know, I realize, you know, with as much gray leaf spots of blight out there, and you know the word rust, he said it's an incubator for you know, types of blights and diseases, and it sure is. And I wanted to bring that up today on this very hot afternoon.
So if this kind of weather continues through the weekend, what do you think it's worth?
Well, you know, the weather community, I think, is feeling this Thursday-Friday event kind of a disappointment as far as a major cure for dry Illinois and parts of Illinois. I think the other factor is that some of the meteorologists are going on out into the future and saying the bias is for heat to continue and a little less rainfall activity. And, of course, I think that's where some of the weather community is divided. But it was also not only a weather event here in the United States. It's a weather event in Russia. In their spring wheat growing area, they produce about 60% of their production of wheat. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier this morning, the Russians like to sell it cheap, quick, and fast. And, of course, they're in the process of harvesting. And, of course, we all remember, you know, they also raise sunflower and oil seeds over there. And, of course, we all remember how in the 70s they were such a market factor. And you mentioned the word Russia, and, of course, the whole world trembled because they sold their gold, booked the freight, sold their gold, and bought corn and soybeans and wheat and pushed the market. But it's not that same game. But we still know that the Russians do like to sell a lot of wheat in the world.
So if we add all of that fundamental news up and overlay it on December futures, do we have a shot at, say, the late February, early March highs around 413?
Well, I think the answer is yes, we have that chance, and I like the word chance. I think it's going to be sometime next week, and looking at the longer range forecast then. We do have a mountain of corn yet to sell. The crops look pretty darn good in lots of places in the United States. And, you know, I think that that's one of the factors. And also, it'll be interesting to see if anyone does panic in the marketplace. And what do we mean by the word panic? You know, possibly a China, you know, possibly other types of people will come into the marketplace and do some buying. The market's probably not as buoyant as it was when we had the big money center banks playing the game. It's probably not with not as many hedge funds playing the game, but it still has a lot of fireworks and money on the sidelines to make something happen.
Let's turn our attention to soybeans, which has its own story to tell, and weather is one of the factors.
Yeah, and of course, you get about 50 miles or 70 miles south of Memphis, north of there, got a good rain, but the rest of the delta, you know, it's pretty rough. Of course, we're looking at beans, a big acreage of beans that were planted after July. We're looking at also the big growing season left to grow, and, of course, August weather is the big factor there. demand for beans is just almost unprecedented. We understand that the Chinese are going to be buying over 1 million tons of soybeans a week. Our carryover is on empty. The basis levels are probably going to be strong clear into harvest time. And there'll be some early beans around, but, you know, it looks like the name of the game is China is probably going to be a buyer. And also it's going to be interesting to see just how aggressive the South American farmer is going to play the game. But we're in the mid $9 range. We're paying over $10 for old crop beans. And the arithmetic is that, you know, it's still going to be a pretty pricey product as we go into harvest.
What else should we watch this week?
Well, I think the, you know, it's going to be an interesting market, but I think the stock market's going to be one to help also basically give us direction. If we can see the stock market to, you know, go stay above, you know, maybe 10,500, that'd be a good sign that maybe the economy's starting to turn around.
10,500 for
the Dow.
Well, the Dow, and any idea about the on the S&P side, perhaps?
Well, I watch the Dow because I like to watch it better. But I tell you what, the 10,500 mark to me is a good level to watch.
All right, Paul, we'll let you go. Thanks
so
much.
Have a profitable day.
You too. That's Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services, and he is in Oakland, Illinois.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
In agricultural news, a bipartisan group of six House members have formed a working group that will focus on bridging differences and resolving outstanding issues that so far have held up consideration of the U.S.-South Korea Free Trade Agreement. The FTA was signed by the Bush administration on June 30, 2007, but has never been presented to Congress for a vote because of Democratic opposition, mainly over the issues of trade in automobiles and auto parts and rules regulating imports of U.S. beef. A new USDA report suggests that taxing caloric sweetened beverages enough to increase the retail price by 20% would reduce caloric intake by an average of 37 calories per day for adults and 43 calories per day for children. The report said the 37-calorie-per-day reduction for adults correlates to 3.8 pounds of body weight per year, and the 43-calorie-per-day reduction for children correlates to 4.5 pounds per year. Officials from USDA and the Department of the Interior held a listening session in Grand Island, Nebraska on Monday as part of the Obama administration's Great Outdoor Initiatives. Officials are asking about the challenges that exist in addressing local goals in conservation or recreation. Last week, USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack highlighted a report from the U.S. Forest Service that showed recreational activities in and around the national forests lead to about $13 billion in direct spending by tourists and another $14.5 billion added to the economy each year. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says that ethanol and other renewable fuels must account for 7.95% of total gasoline sales in 2011 to meet Congress's mandate that 13.95 billion gallons of renewable fuels be produced next year. In 2010, renewable fuels are expected to account for 8.25% of total gasoline sales to reach the mandate of 12.95 billion gallons. The EPA also said it was proposing a lower 2011 cellulosic volume than the 250 million gallons required by Congress based on analysis of market availability of the fuel. The agency said it will continue to evaluate the market as it works to finalize the cellulosic standard in the coming months. EPA also said that it was proposing changes to regulations that could apply to renewable fuel producers that use canola oil, grain sorghum, pulpwood, or palm oil as a feedstock. This proposal would allow the fuel produced by those feedstocks dating back to July 1st of 2010 to be used for compliance should EPA determine in a future rulemaking that those fuels help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. A new poll suggests that China's economic growth will gradually slow as the government withdraws its anti-crisis stimulus, but the expansion will remain robust and inflation well under control. The forecast says that gross domestic product in the world's third largest economy should grow about 10% this year. But the median forecast of 2011 GDP growth has edged down to 9% from 9.2% in April's poll. Turning to trade, the median forecast in the survey is that China's surplus will shrink further to $143.7 billion this year and $100 billion in 2011 from $196.1 billion in 2009. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media and will be filling in for me. I'm Todd Gleason over the next 10 days or so as I'll be out of the office, and he'll be taking the reins. He also writes our weekend newsletter for willag.org. You can always visit the website and sign up for it. He does a great job. If you haven't seen a copy and would like to, it's free. Just visit willag.org and hit subscribe over on the right-hand side of the page. Now, up next, let's take a look back at Friday's USDA WASDE report with Daryl Good and the stock and supply numbers for corn. There were big changes in USDA's world agricultural supply and demand estimate figures July the 9th. University of Illinois ag economist Daryl Good says those changes come as a result of the June acreage and quarterly grain stocks reports.
Those stock numbers as of June 1 were much smaller than the market anticipated. That forced the USDA now to revise upward their expectation of feed and residual use of corn this year by 175 million bushels. That was partially offset by a 50 million bushel decline in expected use for ethanol. But bottom line, they did lower their year-ending stocks projection by 125 million bushels, which takes that under 1.5 billion.
The actual year-ending stocks for this fall, that's what's left in the bin and does not count the crop now in the field. The actual year-ending stocks number for this fall is 1.478 billion bushels. It's a very tight figure, says Daryl Good, and means the amount of corn left in the bin in the fall of 2011 will be even smaller because the starting inventory is off by 125 million bushels, and so is the expected production figure, although there is a 50 million bushel cut in exports.
But bottom line, inventory of September 1, 2011 is now projected 200 million smaller than a month ago, and that takes that number under 1.4 billion bushels. USDA tacked on 15 cents to their expected price range for the 2010-11 crop year, a midpoint of 385 for that crop.
The average USDA predicted cash price for the corn ranges from a low of 345 to a high of $4.05 a bushel.
When we look at the projected price of 385, that's a full 30 cents higher then we're going to average for the 09 crop. So it is a fairly large jump in the average price, although compared to the $4 we've had in 07 and 08, 385 looks a little modest with smaller carryover stocks. So this is about in line with where the market is now, but it does suggest that if anything else goes wrong here on the supply side, that there probably is opportunity for this market to go even higher.
Good says there is talk that excessive rainfall in June has had a negative impact on the corn crop. Even more worrisome are calls for warmer than normal temperatures during the last half of July, which could stress the crop. He thinks the market is already beginning to fade the 163.5 bushels to the acre national yield USDA is dropping into the supply tables for corn. Should that be confirmed in the August crop production report, then the 2010-2011 year ending stocks figure of 1.373 billion bushels will get even smaller. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Joining us now with cash grain analysis is Lisa Jones of the Andersons in Champaign, Illinois. Good afternoon, Lisa.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Been on vacation for a while, and so it was with some curiosity that I took a look at some basis levels around the country. And what jumped out at me immediately is that it appears that hard red winter wheat's at about a six-month high.
It is, and it has been somewhat surprising for us as well. We do some producer sales out actually in Nebraska and have been surprised as we've seen those basis levels that were right in the heart of Nebraska trading at $1.60 or so under the July, you know, now that we've rolled out to the September, trading right around $1.20 under. So with that spread, they've really come in a lot more than what we were expecting early on.
Is corn along for the ride on this wheat?
I don't think we've seen it yet so far. We've seen bean basis kind of firm up here in this area for us and the co-ops around us. But in terms of corn, our basis, we haven't seen any change since mid-March. So kind of heading steady at 30 under the December. And I think that's kind of what we've seen in this part of the Corn Belt.
You mentioned the beans. Are there any old crop beans out there to be had in your area?
There are a few. We've seen some as guys get ready for fall harvest. It's well upon us. Here before too long, we've seen a lot of beans move from this area over into Indiana, but there just weren't a lot of beans to start with last fall being as wet as it was. So we saw smaller numbers to begin with, and I would assume that there's probably less than 4 or 5% of the beans that were put in the bin out there yet, and those are kind of coming to service. And like I said, moving over into east over into Indiana kind of toward that processor market.
How are producers doing with their new crop marketings?
We've seen a lot of producers, after we saw that low a few weeks ago, kind of come back and add on to the sales that they've already had. We'd recommended to guys, you know, to be probably right around that 40 to 60% price level for fall. And we've seen a lot more sales, especially this week, as guys go and get more sales on the book. So I think if you're somewhere between 40 and 60% priced at this point on corn, that's not a bad place to be.
Do you expect corn basis to do any heavy lifting going into the harvest?
I wouldn't think so, considering where elevators in this area can sell trains for fall. I don't think we'll see any great improvement unless we see some dramatic changes. I think we'll probably be somewhere, but we'll see guys somewhere between 35 and probably 28 under the December here, right as fall gets started.
When you talk to producers, what do they tell you about new crop prospects?
I mean, I think a lot of guys are starting to become concerned just from the corn standpoint that haven't seen the rains right here in this part of Champaign County. I spoke with a guy that's up north of Mahomet that has not seen any significant rains over a tenth of an inch since the last week of June. He's starting to see his corn fire at the bottoms and seeing the leaves curl, you know, there at the end of the day after it's been exposed to the sun. So I think we could use, you know, half an inch to an inch of rain here anytime.
Well, it doesn't look like we're going to get it in the next couple of days.
No, Skillings was on today saying that we continue to see rain in the western Corn Belt. Nebraska and Iowa can continue to see continued rains, and by the time it gets to the eastern Corn Belt, we just don't seem to make it. Yeah. So I know we've talked about the line going from Champaign all the way north and east into through Fort Wayne into actually our Toledo area that could use some significant showers if they were available, but they're just not in our forecast.
Very quickly, your prices.
We are cash corn $3.72, fall corn $3.66, cash beans $10.07, and fall beans $9.42.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Lisa Jones of the Andersons in Champaign, Illinois. In 2 minutes, Todd Gleason will be back with a look at the agricultural weather. This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the U.S. and China today jointly announced that China has agreed to open up its market for entertainment goods by March 19th of next year, in line with a World Trade Organization ruling. The U.S. had challenged China's barriers to imports and distribution of books, music, films, and other entertainment products, and China finally lost an appeal in the case at the WTO last December. China had argued that entertainment goods should be handled differently from other imports because of their cultural impact. but the U.S. said that China was wrong to impose monopolies on imports that were authorized for sale or were available through pirated copies. The Mortgage Bankers Association today says that demand for loans to purchase U.S. homes sunk to a 13-year low last week, and refinancing demand also slid despite near-record low mortgage rates. Requests for loans to buy homes dropped 3.1% in the week ending July 9th. Refinancing applications fell 2.9%, and the mortgage market index that reflects total loan demand also fell 2.9%. And Britain pressed China today for better market access for foreign companies, underlying growing worries in the U.S. and the European Union about the difficulties of operating in the world's third largest economy. Britain cited inconsistent application of regulations, concerns over registering and protecting intellectual property, and domestic innovation rules. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Wednesday afternoon. Thanks to Dave Dickey for being along for the ride. Remember, I'll be gone the rest of this week and all next week. He'll be in that slot. Today, though, I get to talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated about the agricultural weather forecast. Hi, Drew. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Hope you're doing the same.
I am getting ready to go on vacation, or at least to take a little time off from the radio station. So I suppose I'm having a happy afternoon. Tell me what the weather forecast looks like. It's a little hot and kind of sticky here.
Yeah, you know, it's starting to look a little like summer.
Yes, it
is. We are looking at some warm and humid weather out there, and it's going to be with us for a while, and I know that we've already been dealing with this for a bit. But what's different about the coming week versus what we've seen in the past week is that there will be less rainfall in the pipeline. We'll still see opportunities for showers coming along periodically, but the general rains that we've seen in recent weeks will probably become a little bit less likely. There will be a frontal boundary that will come across the region. In fact, there may be a couple of them that occur over the coming week. The first one, though, shows up here on Thursday and goes on into Friday. We should see fairly good coverage of rain across the region, but the amounts will be fairly low, running mostly in the range of a few hundredths of an inch up to maybe 3, 4, 5 tenths of an inch for the most part. Now, there could be something locally heavier embedded in there where somebody can come in with an inch or more, but we're talking about counties now and not necessarily portions of states and that kind of thing. So we are moving into a period where we see a lot of net drying at this time of the year. There is a second opportunity for some rain to move into the region as we go into the latter part of the weekend and early next week. Rainfall will be erratically distributed across a fair amount of the region with this next disturbance, and I would expect to see some areas end up with some locally heavy rainfall while others will get virtually nothing. And because of that, we'll end up with pockets of drying starting next week and will likely be with us as we finish out the month of July. I don't know that we're going to see widespread serious dryness issues, but I do think we'll have pockets that will start to evolve. And this parallels with 1998 when we moved from an El Nino to a La Nina event, and that year a lot of the rainfall distribution started to diminish as we got into the late July-August time frame. The time we got into September, it was pretty darn dry across a fair amount of the Midwest.
And so pod filling and filling out of the corn might have a rough time?
Well, yes, I think the corn crop will probably do pretty well. Some of the late crop there might run into a little bit of stress and might lose a bushel or here or there, but it's the soybean crop that would probably be most at risk of some greater losses if we actually got into an environment where we really got dry and warm. But like I said, this is something we'll build into gradually. It's not going to happen overnight and probably favors the latter half of August and into September.
Thanks so much, Drew.
Have a good day.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. Stay with us if you can for the Farming World. We'll run an archive edition today. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to Illinois Public Media. Of course, it is a production of the University of Illinois. We're on the phone today with Bob Dineen. He's the president and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association and is based in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for joining us today, Bob. How are you?
I am terrific, Todd. Good to be with you.
Well, let's talk about the Renewable Fuels Association. Some of our audience, of course, will be very familiar with the RFA and what it does and what it promotes in the world of ethanol, but some of them will not. Can you tell us, please?
Sure. The Renewable Fuels Association is the national trade association that represents the U.S. ethanol industry. Our membership includes producers, but also suppliers to the industry, and we work in Washington, D.C. to assure that there is strong public policy support that will allow the industry to continue to grow and develop.
How long has it been around?
The RFA has been around for almost 30 years now, and we've seen a great deal of growth over that time, so it's been pretty exciting. I've been with the RFA myself for 22 of those 30 years. So I've seen an awful lot of change within this industry.
And for those who'd like to learn more about it, they can always visit you online. That's probably pretty easy to do at ethanolrfa.org.
Absolutely. Right? Thank you.
Well, I have it in front of me. And so we've got many questions to start out with. Let's talk about the policy things in the very beginning of the RFA some 30 years ago in the late 80s when ethanol was a small industry, relatively speaking, located primarily in Decatur, Illinois. What were the types of things that the RFA was pushing, and what have you achieved over the three decades?
Well, when ethanol first started out as a small industry, it was, of course, focused on trying to reduce our dependence on imported oil, and there were a lot of small gasoline marketers that were using our products early on, and they would blend ethanol in order to add octane, extend fuel supplies, and actually be able to compete cost-effectively with their major refiners, who were also their competitors in the marketplace, but their suppliers as well. But what was really important in the early days of the industry was a tax incentive that refiners and gasoline marketers would claim. And that tax incentive allowed the gasoline marketers to offer ethanol-blended fuels to the consumers quite cost-effectively. As ethanol gained in public acceptance, people began to realize that it was actually reducing emissions. And in 1990... the Congress, for the very first time, actually required gasoline marketers and refiners to reduce emissions from their product, and required a reformulated gasoline program that had with it an oxygen requirement associated with it, and that prompted some significant growth in ethanol as well. At the time, though, Todd, there were really two oxygenates that were being used. Ethanol was one, but MTBE was another. And MTBE, methyl tertiary butyl ether, was a petroleum-derived oxygenate that did everything that ethanol did. It just had this one problem. When it was in gasoline, it would find its way to water supplies. And so by the late 1990s, when people began to see MTBE showing up in their water, like Kankakee, Illinois, there was an effort to remove MTBE from gasoline. And it was really those actions in the late 1990s that took this industry from 1 billion gallons or 2 billion gallons of production to where we're seeing it today. We will this year produce some 12 billion gallons of ethanol, and it was because refiners, you know, really have to use ethanol in their reformulated gasoline programs to reduce emissions. But now as well, as a result of legislation that was passed just a few years ago, the renewable fuel standard that required refiners to utilize us. So over the span of 20 years, you saw ethanol being used as a gasoline extender, then as a means of reducing emissions, and over the last several years, as a way for refiners to meet the renewable fuel standard that allows ethanol to be blended and other biofuels to be blended in gasoline, and has really resulted in significant growth in the industry.
The ethanol industry has always talked about themselves as energy security for the United States. Was 9/11 a seminal event in the political landscape that allowed ethanol to grow to its current size?
Well, that's an astute observation, Todd, because, you know, we had been trying as an industry, working with some in the environmental community and others, to create a renewable fuel standard around the beginning of 2000-2001. But when that horrible event occurred, it certainly did crystallize for members of Congress the very real impact of our dependency on imported oil on that part of the world with regimes that didn't like us very much. And there was renewed effort to get more domestic renewable fuels like ethanol into the marketplace that eventually resulted in the renewable fuel standard being passed in 2005. But clearly, the energy security issue has been one that has resonated on the Hill and also resonates with the public, because I think people do recognize that we need to reduce our dependence on imported petroleum if we are ever truly going to be secure as a nation.
Nearly a decade out, not quite that far from that event, has the political will to continue to use alternative energy sources begun to wane yet or not?
No, it really hasn't. What you've seen is the success of the renewable fuel standard that was passed in 2005. And initially, it required 7.5 billion gallons of ethanol to be produced. And there was a lot of talk at the time, oh, the ethanol industry will never be able to grow to meet that much demand. And, you know, what an aggressive target that was. But within a couple of years, we had demonstrated not only we could produce that much, but we could likely produce far more. And so even by 2007, the Congress then expanded that program to be just not a 7.5 billion gallon requirement, but a 36 billion gallon requirement, and also targeted that growth for continued evolution in the industry, so that we're not just producing from grain, we might also be producing from cellulosic materials, things like municipal solid waste or woody biomass or corn cobs or agricultural residues, but other materials that will just greatly expand the feedstocks that we're able to utilize in the production of a domestic renewable fuel. And that program also has been extraordinarily successful, and you've seen the industry continue to grow. As I said, this year we will produce more than 12 billion gallons of ethanol. And, you know, there are a number of companies that are today looking at producing ethanol from a variety of feedstocks. And we're confident we're going to get to that 36 billion gallon number by 2022, which is what the statute requires. This administration, like the previous one, has continued the focus on the evolution of the industry, moving us to new feedstocks, to more carbon-sensitive technologies. And it's truly a very exciting time in the industry.
In the March issue of Ethanol Producer Magazine, and I think you write probably for each issue, it's a monthly magazine, a commentary, mm-hmm. You write an article called View from the Hill. In the March issue, you titled The Ethanol Decade Redo, and one of the paragraphs reads about the things that maybe you think need yet to be done or still to be done in Washington, D.C., and you write extending the tax incentives for ethanol blending, increasing the blending wall, implementing and defending the renewable fuel standard, and formulating a fair national low-carbon fuels policy are all necessary for the industry to succeed. Maybe we can take those up in order and start with extending the tax incentives. Why is it necessary to continue to do that when it appears that the ethanol industry, at least at this point, has a pretty good footing across at least the Midwest?
Well, we do have a good footing, and it is because of the foundation of public policy support that encourages refiners to blend our product, because, you know, left to their own devices, oil companies wouldn't necessarily want to use a product that they don't produce and that they don't control, and they'd be happy enough just continuing the nation's dependence on petroleum and, you know, even imported petroleum. The tax incentive has always been the very foundation of the public policy program. It allows gasoline marketers to purchase our product and compete with major refiners. It allows our industry to innovate, to seek new technologies. It will allow the continued evolution of the industry to go on. And in the absence of the tax incentive, our analysis would show that you would likely lose approximately 38% of domestic production. And we would have to import greater supplies of foreign-produced ethanol that is subsidized in order to compete, and would lose perhaps as many as 112,000 jobs. So, you know, the tax incentive is going to continue to be extraordinarily important to the continued growth and development of the industry. You know, at some point, we all want the federal involvement in the ethanol industry to cease. But right now, with energy being so highly subsidized across the globe, not just in this country, and with the oil industry continuing to get a number of subsidies and support from the government, there's not a level playing field. And so the government needs to make choices in order to have the kind of energy that is going to promote rural economic development, promote environmental stewardship, promote energy security. And so the tax incentive is going to help to do that. It is one that has paid for itself in terms of reducing farm program costs, increasing tax revenues, creating jobs, lowering our dependence, and I believe it needs to be extended.
Can you turn your attention to one of the next things on the list? And we hear a lot about this in the world of agriculture. It's called the blend wall. Can you tell me what it is?
Sure. In the 1980s, when ethanol was just a blip on the U.S. energy scene, EPA had limited the amount of ethanol that could be blended into a gallon of gasoline to 10% per gallon. Now, at the time, you know, that seemed just fine. At the time, you know, ethanol was only being blended in a few states in the Midwest, and being 10% of the nation's motor transportation fuel seemed to be a target that we would never reach. But with the growth in the ethanol industry, with policies like the tax incentive and the renewable fuel standard, we are now at the point where ethanol is blended in 90% of the nation's motor fuel at 10% per volume in each gallon of gasoline. And we are nearing the point where you're not going to be able to blend more ethanol into gasoline unless EPA increases the limitation on how much ethanol can be blended into every gallon.
You're listening to an archive edition of The Farming World. Our guest is Bob Dineen of the RFA. We recorded the program and ran it for the very first time on April the 5th of this year. I'm Todd Gleason. More in a moment.
It's Cow Appreciation Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1850, the refrigerated ice-making machine was first demonstrated by Dr. John Gorey, who eventually received a patent for the machine on May 6th of 1851. In 1857, Frederick Louis Maytag was born, an American industrialist. Maytag was one of the founders of a farm implement company in Newton, Iowa. They made threshing machines, band cutters, and self-feeder attachments. In 1907, the company began producing the Maytag washing machine to make up for the seasonal nature of the farm equipment business. The first machine, the Parsons Pastime, featured a hand-powered wood tub. In 1868, the first patent for a spring tape measure was issued to Alvin J. Fellows of New Haven, Connecticut. The tape measure was enclosed in a circular case with a spring click lock to hold the tape at any desired point. In 1943, George Washington Carver was honored with a national monument near his childhood home near Diamond Grove, Missouri. Carver was a prolific agricultural researcher, instructor, and chemical investigator. And in 1986, Raymond Lowry died, an American design engineer. He is known as the father of streamlining. Famous examples of his designs include the 1947 Studebaker Starlight Coupe and the Coca-Cola bottle. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
You're listening to an archive edition of The Farming World. It dates from the 5th day of April, 2010. Our guest, Bob Dineen of the RFA. He serves as the CEO and president of the Renewable Fuels Association. Our discussion had taken a turn to the blend wall when we last spoke with him before the break. We'll continue now, and he explains what that blend wall is and how it differs in other parts of the world.
And we have petitioned EPA to lift that somewhat arbitrary limitation. In other parts of the globe, in Brazil, for example, every single gallon of gasoline is blended with 25% ethanol. And the vehicles in Brazil, although may be slightly different in terms of some of their emissions controls, they are largely the same as the vehicles sold here, and they are produced by companies like General Motors and Ford and Toyota and other companies that sell vehicles here as well. So we don't believe that there is a technical barrier to how much ethanol you could add into gasoline. There is a political barrier. And we hope that sometime over the course of this summer, the Environmental Protection Agency will evaluate all of the data that has been submitted and recognize that E15 is certainly well within the bounds of what is technically feasible in today's technology, and lift that limitation and allow the ethanol industry to continue to grow. We have a 130 billion gallon gasoline market today, and we'll be selling 12 billion gallons of ethanol into that market. So we are very close to the theoretical maximum of what you could blend in gasoline. Now, next year, in 2011, more than 13 billion gallons of renewable fuels is going to be required. And if the limit is remains of 10% per gallon, refiners aren't going to have enough gallons of gasoline being sold into the marketplace to blend 10% ethanol into to meet that requirement. So, you know, you'd have to have much more E85 sales than we see today, many more flexible fueled vehicles on the road to utilize that fuel than are available today, and too many other things need to happen in order to absorb the amount of ethanol and other renewable fuels that are required.
Do you think that the automobiles, most of them in the United States, can manage a blend at E15?
I have absolutely no doubt that automobiles on the road today would be able to utilize E15 without any difficulty whatsoever. Again, this really is not a technical challenge. It is a political challenge.
And finally, last question. I understand how probably corn farmers in the industry would benefit. What benefit is there to the consumer?
Oh, there's a huge benefit to the consumer. The very fact that ethanol is now such a significant part of the total U.S. motor fuel market, we are helping to reduce consumer gasoline costs significantly. A study that was done by Morgan Stanley a bit more than a year ago now said that the global supply of ethanol as it is growing so rapidly, was actually helping to reduce crude oil prices by as much as 15%. That translates into savings at the gasoline pump of as much as 50 cents a gallon at times. And if you were to take that amount of ethanol away, and we would have to find that much more imported petroleum to make up for the lost ethanol, the impact on consumer gasoline prices would be substantial. You know, think about it in this country. Anytime there is a hiccup in the refining or distribution of gasoline, prices go through the roof. Consumers in Illinois see it frequently when a refiner will go down and production is reduced. You'll see spikes in gasoline prices. Well, those spikes would happen permanently were ethanol not to be such an important part of the U.S. motor transportation system.
Mr. Dineen, thank you so much for joining us today. We do appreciate it.
Todd, thank you very much. Appreciate you having me on today.
You're very welcome. Bob Dineen is the president and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. You can find more online at ethanolrfa.org. This program is a production of Illinois Public Media. You have a good afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason. You've been listening to an archive edition of The Farming World. If you have questions or comments, concerns about our agricultural programming, please don't hesitate to contact Dave Dickey or myself, Todd Gleason. You can get to both of us by email in one single stroke at willagstaff.illinois.edu. That's willagstaff@illinois.edu, willagstaff@illinois.edu, or by calling this phone number. It's 217-333-1070, 217-333-1070. We look forward to hearing from you. Your questions, comments, and your concerns are always welcomed here at Illinois Public Media.